Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Ursula Rudenberg, and I am here with Kay Puttock. Hello, Kay, and hello to you, the listener.
As we all know, this is an unusual time in Iowa. Donald Trump was in Ames yesterday, with Sarah Palin. Reporter Jim Werbel gave us his impressions.
This is Jim Werbel reporting from the Hansen Center. I talked to numerous people at the Trump rally, and I'd like to just quickly summarize some of the comments that people made about Donald Trump. My general impression of the crowd is it's a large crowd. A lot of people really want to listen to Donald Trump. It's a very diverse age group. Young people are here that seem to be supporting Donald Trump. Older people support Donald Trump. I will say that the audience is heavily male. There weren't really any women that wanted to speak to me on behalf of Donald Trump. Some people just liked what he says and the way he says it. Some people actually commented on they appreciate his willingness to be candid and not worry about political correctness. There was a military veteran that I talked to, and he commented that he really believed that Donald Trump would be very good at projecting military strength, which was very important to him. Another person eloquently commented that Donald Trump is a leader. He's a business leader. This is what is needed in this world. He knows how to make decisions. He knows how to bring people together and make good decisions. While he may not be knowledgeable about anything, he knows how to rely on others to make important decisions. One person talked to me about the fact that he was going to be real tough on immigration and that he would be very good at rebuilding the country economically. Thus, it would appear to be that there's no one real reason that's driving the diverse opinions about Donald Trump. But there seems to be diverse opinions that make him quite appealing to vote for Donald Trump.
And that was KHOI reporter James Werbel, and he was reporting from the Donald Trump rally that happened yesterday here in Ames. And as we said before, these are extraordinary times in Iowa. It is countdown to caucus time, and this year in particular, there's a tremendous amount of attention on Iowa. In the latter part of the show, we will be bringing you some interesting and contrasting perspectives on politics in these days before the caucuses. But before we do that, first we wanted to tell you about something here on the county level. Recently, the Story County Board of Supervisors approved a proclamation to raise awareness of Iowa's puppy mills. The proclamation is sponsored by the nonprofit organization Iowa Friends of Companion Animals, which is headquartered in Des Moines, Iowa. Mary LaHaye is the president of this organization, and she has joined us now by phone to explain. Mary, welcome to KHOI's Local Talk. We wanted to just ask you a little bit about what the meaning of this proclamation is, and for starters, maybe you could explain what the term puppy mill really refers to.
Sure. And it is a subjective term. It will be different depending on who you ask. But bottom line is that these are large-scale mass-producing facilities where large numbers of dogs are kept to pump out puppies for distribution to the wholesale pet trade all across the country to pet stores. And the proclamation is to bring awareness to the fact that we are having a lobby day at the state capitol on February 3rd, and the proclamation is proclaiming February 3rd as Iowa Puppy Mill Awareness Day.
And Iowa is actually known for having an unusual amount of puppy mills, is that correct?
Correct. We have the second largest number of these USDA licensees in the country. Missouri has the largest number, and then we're number two with approximately 216 is our count right now. And they house a combined approximate 15,000 adult dogs.
So that's why attention is being brought to this at
this
time?
And the fact that more than half of these breeders were cited for violations to the Animal Welfare Act during 2015. So we have some really horrendously cruel conditions out there for these animals.
Why exactly are puppy mills cruel or bad for dogs?
Well, a lot of them are keeping them in bare minimum survival standards requirements. They are often kept in cages that are nothing more than 6 inches longer than the length of their body. That's all the USDA requires. Many of them are living on cage bottoms that are graded so that their feet are damaged by the wiring. Many of them are not afforded any sort of protection from the elements. Many of them are out in this cold right now. Lots of injuries, illnesses that go unattended. The list goes on, and it's just unacceptable.
Is there some sort of understanding why these conditions occur? Is it because the animals are just being used for breeding, or what, yes. What leads to this?
Yes, and a sick, injured animal, dog, still gives birth to cute, fluffy puppies, and those are the products that get exported. So to have a sickly, injured adult dog is not really a deterrent to the breeder making a living off of the puppies. It may reduce the number of puppies they can produce, but if they keep a whole bunch of adult dogs, they're still producing a lot of puppies. And they can pump these puppies out as fast as they want to, as fast as they can, and they've always got a market for them because they're distributed all over the country.
You had mentioned in your release that many of these puppies coming out of these kennels are not the best in terms of health. Can you explain?
Exactly. It is a huge consumer protection issue also. I receive calls every month from someone somewhere in the country who's purchased a puppy in a pet store, and that puppy becomes ill or develops some sort of genetic problem, and they trace the puppy back, and they find that it comes from Iowa, and they contact me asking for advice. I got a call just yesterday. I was up at the Capitol talking to legislators about the bill that we're working on, and lo and behold, I get a call from a gentleman in New Jersey. He and his family spent a lot of money on a puppy in a pet store in that state, and now it is requiring hundreds and hundreds of dollars worth of vet care. And he contacted me asking me for any kind of advice. He's got kids who are just heartbroken by this. And it's a lot of money out of their pocket because these are not disposable widgets that can just be tossed aside and you can chalk that up to experience. These are living creatures that become family members to a lot of these consumers, and they are being bilked big time.
Hmm. Is there a particular type of dog that comes out of these puppies' mill, a particular breed?
No, you see everything. There is sort of somewhat of a focus on the designer breeds that a lot of people like, what are considered hypoallergenic dogs that are crossbreeds with poodles and things like that. But you'll find everything out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I had the impression, first of all, that they tended to be small dogs because they can fit in small cages, but apparently no. Great Danes and all sorts of things.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So why is such an issue allowed to exist in Iowa? Why does it continue?
Right now, this industry in Iowa is only overseen by the USDA. These facilities are licensed and inspected by the USDA. Of the top four dog breeding states, ours is the only state that does not also have state-level oversight of these federally licensed facilities. And I think that contributes to a lot of the problems. The USDA is not required to uphold our state statutes. So if they encounter a violation of our state animal cruelty statute, which I'm quite sure many of these violations would qualify, the USDA is not required to report that to anyone. And so we are looking to get state oversight of these facilities so that that can happen, so that there's just another set of eyes on this problem. You know, as I said before, this is not just a product being stamped out in some sort of a production line. These are sentient beings that deserve our protection.
Yeah, and I remember when I was talking to you once before, Mary, you pointed out that the USDA is it's their job to inspect the food that we eat, you know, the animal products. And they haven't got really time for this, and this is a very low priority.
Very low priority.
So that's another reason that we need state oversight.
Yes, exactly. Thank you for...
What exactly is the Iowa Friends?
Iowa Friends of Companion... Well, there's two sister organizations, I believe.
Correct.
Iowa Friends of Companion Animals and Iowa Voters for Companion Animals.
Yes.
So could you sort of explain the difference there?
Sure. Iowa Friends is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Through that organization, we do our research and education tasks, and donations to that organization are tax deductible, and we qualify for grants. And Iowa Voters is a 501c4, and through that organization we can do unlimited lobbying up at our Capitol to get laws passed, but donations to that organization are not tax deductible.
Yeah, and you succeeded in passing an act in 2010, I believe. What were the provisions of that?
What that did was made it possible for the first time for our Iowa Department of Agriculture to even go into these facilities if they received a complaint. That was something that the Animal Rescue League of Iowa here in Des Moines had started. We just helped them some muscle behind that.
Uh-huh.
So it was a good first step. But uh-huh. The fact of the matter is nobody ever gets in these places to see what they need to see to be able to make a complaint.
Right.
We need something more.
How did you personally get involved?
I stumbled upon a puppy mill. My husband and I were in the market for a puppy, and we went to a facility that's now closed in Altoona, and we witnessed the conditions firsthand, and I figured it was just an anomaly, and I started doing some research and found how common it is and just how big of a problem it is. And I came to realize after consulting with Tom Colvin at ARL that it really required a very concerted effort by an organization that could focus on the legislation. So
mm-hmm.
that's what
mm-hmm.
I did.
What advice would you have for somebody now who is shopping for a pet, for a puppy?
Thanks for asking. Absolutely, positively, you must visit the kennel and you must meet the mother of the puppy and you have to see where she lives. And if you're either denied that or cannot do that for any reason, whether that be that, you know, the excuses we hear are things like our insurance doesn't allow people to come into our kennel, or you might bring in disease, or, you know, just all kinds of excuses. Don't accept any of those. And if you buy online or through a pet store, you don't have that opportunity either. Any of those scenarios, you are more than likely supporting a very cruel industry, and you are very likely to end up with a very not healthy animal.
Mm-hmm. I would like to add, even if it's not a puppy mill, now I made this mistake. I met the mother of both the parents of the dog I've got now, who is beautiful and I love her, but she's got all sorts of health problems. She was a purebred, but the breeder didn't really breed her carefully.
Right.
So that's another issue. But at least, you know, my dog's parents were happy. They had a pleasant life.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what exactly does this proclamation that was just issued by Story County, what does it do in reality?
It's raising awareness. We're just mm-hmm. getting the word out. What we're learning is that just like me, and I'm a lifelong Iowan, nobody knows this is going on in our state. Very few people know that this is going on in our state. And when they find out, they aren't willing to put up with it. And we need those people to get behind us to do something to help these animals because we cannot do it on our own. That's the primary reason for the proclamation.
I think you've got some canine support for that statement.
I'm running to get away from them.
We're speaking with Mary LaHaye, who's the president of Iowa Friends of Companion Animals, and you're in Des Moines, and we're talking about the proclamation approved by the Story County Board of Supervisors to raise awareness of Iowa's puppy mills. And Mary was telling us that she came into this issue when she went to buy a dog herself. And obviously, you do have a dog. So who is your dog?
I've got a couple. Two of them, I actually have three. Two of them have been rescued from puppy mills and are just very sweet animals. And the other one is the puppy that I actually ended up buying in the beginning when I first started doing research. I did end up buying from a breeder that I was able to assess, but since then I'm rescuing dogs instead.
Okay. Thank you for joining us. And presumably you have a website where one could find more information.
Sure. IAfriends.org. There's a place out there to register for our lobby day. There's a place out there to sign up for our e-newsletters to stay informed. We make it so simple for people to lobby on behalf of these animals, and we need people to do that because Iowa can do better than this.
Iowa can do better. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Oh, prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Or abridging the freedom of speech.
Free speech.
Yeah. Or abridging the freedom of press.
Free press.
Or the right of the people
peacefully to assemble.
Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people's stories and events in Central Iowa. And that was the Reverend Billy and the Church of Stop Shopping singing the First Amendment. I'm one of your hosts, Kay Puttock, together with my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg. In anticipation of the caucuses, we have a variety of voices that we'd like to share with you. The first one is a national figure. Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright contacted KHOI last week while she was in Iowa campaigning for Hillary Clinton. Reporter Greta Anderson spoke to her.
Secretary Albright, I know that you're in Iowa to support Hillary Clinton. Could you describe your relationship with Mrs. Clinton when she was in the White House and you were Secretary of State?
Well, I have had a very good and long relationship with Hillary Clinton. And it really began officially when I was ambassador at the United Nations and she was First Lady. And she would come up, I would introduce her to a lot of the other ambassadors there. Because she was truly interested in how it all functioned, and we went together to Beijing for the Women's Conference, where she made that remarkable statement about women's rights being human rights and human rights women's rights. And then when I was secretary, we did an awful lot of things together. Sometimes we traveled together, and we were kind of a tag team in dealing with a variety of groups in whatever country we were in, and I saw something about her already, which was that she certainly could do the big meetings with the officials, but she really liked going out and meeting with the people and listening and getting a sense of what was going on. We have obviously continued to work together for when she was senator and when she was Secretary of State. So we have spent a lot of time together, and I think we have never had a candidate for president that is as experienced and prepared as she is.
Could you tell me, give an example of, when she was Secretary of State, your roles kind of switched and you were observing. Is there a particular incident that you felt she handled particularly well? Could you give an example?
Well, I think there are many, actually, but I think that she's really the one that got a lot of the discussions with the Iranians started through getting people privately to meet together. I think she also was instrumental in having us understand the importance of dealing in Asia, the rebalancing to Asia, spending time, really making clear how important our relationship with China was. Then also, I think what's really important is restoring our reputation after what the Gulf War had done in terms of the war in Iraq had done, and in fact really making clear that it was essential for us to have a role, to work with others, to build coalitions, going up to the United Nations, meeting with people. There's a whole set of issues that show her desire to work in partnership with others and at the same time really make clear what America's values are.
Well, speaking of America's values of democracy, I wanted to ask about the Arab Spring. You know, that was a very exciting time to see that region of the world explode with democratic revolution. Is there anything our leadership could have done to make some of that democracy stick a little better?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. I actually am myself chairman of the board of an organization called the National Democratic Institute that works abroad. Democracy is hard. We see it in our own country. And I think that what we were doing as a country, I think, was trying to be supportive of people who wanted change, who did not want to live under dictatorships, or somebody like Muammar Gaddafi, who had basically said that his people were cockroaches and he was going to kill them, and being supportive of those who were calling for democracy. I think that in many ways we can see that the countries had to do it themselves. And one of the examples where we were supportive and they were doing it themselves was in Tunisia. In other countries, it's been more complicated. I don't think we could have done more. I think that we were doing the right things and really moving forward, but it's a complicated, long story. I can tell you, though, something. I was talking to people in Egypt, and they said, and I was explaining, democracy is about compromise. And they said, yeah, like you guys. So at this moment, our problem was more that some of the gridlock that was taking place here was not providing good example of what needs to be done to really have a functioning democracy. It all goes together.
Huh. So Hillary is quite a polarizing figure. Why do you think the Republicans hate her so much?
I have to tell you, the only thing I can think of is they know how strong she is, how much she will fight for America, how important she, because she's able to do something else that I think makes them nervous. She knows how to combine domestic and foreign policy. She is very smart on both of them, and I think they see her as the person that is threatening to their candidacies. But I find her somebody who has the capability of listening to different views, of absorbing. I think the very important thing about a leader is knowing how to listen, and she knows how to do that. And some of the other people, the Republicans that are running, seem to have don't have that quality.
And finally, would you like to comment on the news this morning that Iran has been certified as passing its jumping through the hoops it needed to, and that the sanctions have been lifted from Iran?
Well, I think that it's this was all laid out very carefully in the agreement, and this is what's known as Implementation Day. It's the beginning of a process in so many ways, because we have to really make clear that we continue to have eyes on everything. Hillary, Secretary Clinton had said, distrust but verify. I think we really do have to verify everything. I think people need to be clear that American sanctions have not been lifted. Those sanctions have to do with the fact that Iran has supported terrorism. There are international sanctions that have been lifted, but this is the beginning of a story, and now we have to watch Iran's behavior, but it's the right step.
Okay, so American sanctions have not been lifted. International sanctions are what have been
right,
lifted.
Right, yes. Our sanctions have to do with the fact that Iran is a country that we believe supports terrorism, so our sanctions have not been lifted.
Okay, and this has nothing to do with the 10 sailors who were caught in Iranian waters?
No, I mean, the thing with the sailors is that the fact that we were able to get that resolved as quickly as we did, I think is a sign that it was a good idea to be dealing with Iran. That one of the problems is when you have no relations with a country at all, you have no way of changing their behavior. And Hillary was one of the, when she was secretary, as I said earlier, really began a lot of those contacts. And so the sailors, as Secretary of Defense now has said, there was some navigational issue that was the problem. And as a result of the contacts that were developed through these negotiations, I think it was possible to resolve that relatively quickly.
Okay. Well, I thank you for your time. I apologize for our frigid Iowa weather.
I had actually, yesterday I was on the road for 12 hours. I went to Clinton and Dubuque and Acora and Waterloo and met with a lot of really motivated people that are going to go out, weather or no weather, knocking on doors and getting support. And the organization is working, and I was very, very pleased to be here and delighted to continue my travels today. Thank you so much for spending time with me, Greta.
Thank you, Madeline. Secretary Albright.
Great. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Greta Anderson, and she was speaking with former Secretary of State Madeline Albright, who is transversing Iowa in the dead of winter, and who says democracy is about compromise. Democracy is hard. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa in anticipation of caucus night.
During the upcoming weekend before the caucuses, the United Church of Christ here in Ames will be hosting a series of discussions and forums called God and Government, Are Religious Liberties Crumbling? That's January the 30th and 31st. The public is invited. On Sunday, the 31st at 9 o'clock, there will be a panel discussion with many deeply contrasting viewpoints, ranging from progressive to conservative. All of the presentations will be held at the United Church of Christ, which is at 217 6th Street on the corner of Kellogg in downtown Ames. The visiting theologian will be Barry Lynn, who's executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, a timely topic during this election period. Barry Lynn is a theologian and a lawyer, and he's written many books on this subject.
Dr. Charles Knicker is the coordinator of the event at the United Church of Christ, and he stopped by the studio yesterday to tell us about the event. So we asked him, first of all, to tell us about United Church of Christ and their approach to church-state issues. So he told us a little bit of their history.
What is now the United Church of Christ here in Ames began as the first church in Ames in 1865. So we've just celebrated our 150th anniversary. And so happens I'm a historian by training in part. And so I'm writing the history of that 150-year history. So if you go back to the very beginning, that church was involved always with outside causes, so to speak. Now, one of the very first ones, 13 young women from that church, just like 2 or 3 years after its founding, marched down to the first saloon here in Ames and suggested to the saloon keeper that he might be on the next train out of town. And it took a little doing, but he was. He left town. And we didn't have another saloon here in Ames until 1930s.
Interesting.
But they were very much involved with women's rights, voter rights,
etc. Yeah, that was tied up in the early days.
Yeah, that, so there were temperance total, was another
temperance
right.
Temperance and women's rights.
And women's rights. So the church has been there, and it started missionary work both here in the States and abroad. So it seems that our church has always had a very strong interest in social justice issues. And so with the many issues in politics these days, we think there are certainly ethical concerns about being well-informed citizens and citizens that speak to ethical issues.
That's Mr. Knicker. He's with the United Church of Christ. Forums and panel discussions will be held at the United Church of Christ on January 30th and 31st. And the topic really is the issue of separation of church and state. And so we asked Mr. Knicker to explain why the United Church of Christ feels that the separation of church and state is such an important issue at this election time.
Especially for a church, people don't usually...
Right, you'd think. Right. And actually, that's interesting. And the title that we chose for the theme of this program is we picked up Barry's words to begin with, God and government. And then, though, we asked the question, are religious liberties crumbling? Because Ted Cruz and I think Mike Huckabee and others did attend what they call a religious liberties conference. The First Amendment does have what you call the Establishment Clause. There shall be no establishment of a religion nor shall there be the prohibition of the free exercise of religion.
Right.
And in some ways, they almost seem a bit contradictory, and that's why you always have these courts.
Yeah.
But a group of Baptists, the Danbury Baptist Association in Connecticut, in 1801 wrote to President Thomas Jefferson saying, well, what does all of that mean? What does that First Amendment really mean? And Jefferson wrote a letter back. It's become a very famous letter. He very much believed that there should be a separation. And he said the way it is set up, he argued or concluded that it created a wall of separation between church and state.
What created a wall?
The First Amendment.
First Amendment. These two clauses. And, of course, some people have said, well, we think that wall should crumble.
How does the UCC feel about that?
We do not have that hierarchy where we have a central office saying, well, these are, you must believe these things. So I'd have to say it's really wide open. I think generally because we're a liberal denomination, we I think probably would lean toward that a separationist perspective, that it's a healthier environment if the church doesn't control our governance, which some people would call a theocracy. Mm-hmm. It's better if you have separation because then the church can feel free to criticize what the government is doing and is not beholden to the government as in maybe many European countries where you've had or still have a state church. I think it's that the church is able to say, we don't like
what
the government is doing.
So by keeping that separation, the church is, in a sense, free to create its own principles and to speak on those.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
sometimes they would align with the government and sometimes they wouldn't. But then the church can accept the government as existing without it.
Yes. I guess I'm pretty much of a separationist. I really think historically, as I've studied church history, when we go through periods when the church is really determining or controlling government, I don't think it functions as well. I think it's by being independent you certainly should speak up as to when the government makes certain decisions.
What do you mean by being independent?
Well, again, I think that a European model are that you do have an official state religion so that people belong to that church when they're born and that the government then pays the churches, you know, helps pay the minister's salaries.
So mm-hmm. are you saying that the church and religion is not needed for humans to govern themselves fairly?
I believe that we have been given intelligence by God. And yes, no, we have many flaws. But in point of fact, as we try to then live in a corporate life, we cannot ask everybody to believe exactly the same thing.
What do you mean by corporate life?
Well, our society, when we form communities. I think humans are created with intelligence. That being said, then societies will organize. Whether you say one way or another, is this God-given how we form our groups? I just think there's a diversity of groups and a diversity of forms of government. And so therefore, if you say, well, it has to be organized by God or under God, well, who's God then are you talking about?
Yeah.
What perspective do you have theologically?
Government can be trusted without coming directly from God. So are you saying that you see government as being able to be organized without directly referencing God?
Yes, actually I do. Right.
Do you see humans as able to do that without directly seeing it as the Word of God?
Yes.
Does this diminish the mission of the United Church of Christ?
No. And I think I am going to rely on some Supreme Court decisions. The courts cannot favor one religion over another religion.
So there is, in a sense, a separation
between
all churches and the state.
Right. And furthermore, that you cannot favor religion over non-religion. My major was Hebrew scriptures, or we used to say Old Testament, in seminary. And again, when you look at the prophets, Jeremiah is known for disrupting a presidential inauguration. To me, there's a real strong tradition of just saying, you're supposed to be godly.
of seeing government as a human activity.
It's a human activity.
That can be criticized.
That can really be criticized.
The principle of your approach to religion is a tradition of maintaining an independent stance to ask whether a government or a religion or any activity is socially responsible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so what is the operating principle at the heart of the UCC?
Well, we definitely believe in study of the Bible and study of ethical issues. We're a tradition that believes in educated clergy. So I think there is that standpoint. You are going to deal with the Bible, but also you are going to look at church history and what have we learned from history. So I think what have been the ideas of the past, we don't reject them. And then we do look at the social justice of what is going on today, what increases the love of God and neighbor.
And critical analysis plays a role in that.
Oh, a very big part of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Would you say it's an outlook that has faith in human nature? Ability to do that?
I think you would have, again, within the United Church of Christ, you would have that spectrum that some might believe that, you know, the old line, some people believe that humans are basically good and others believe that humans are basically flawed.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and that was Mr. Knicker from the United Church of Christ. Earlier, we did hear Reverend Billy and the Church of Stop Shopping singing the First Amendment, to which Mr. Knicker is referring to. And since the issue of church and state is being raised, we asked KHOI's radio host, Steve Weiler, to recite again the First Amendment for us. So let's hear Steve, the great voice.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people, peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
Okay, tell us which part of the First Amendment actually refers to the issue we're listening to today, which is the separation of church and state.
Just the first two clauses. Not
which are?
Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. In other words, there won't be a state religion that's supported by the state. That's what it means by establishment. Maybe some people would argue about that, but that's what the Supreme Court seems to believe. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. And then the second clause, which in a way might be seen as sort of in opposition to that, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So church cannot be suppressed by the state. On the other hand, no church can be favored by the state.
Mr. Knicker himself acknowledged different ways to interpret this First Amendment. And so in the last part of the program, we want to bring a different perspective on the issues of church and state. This is a viewpoint that's been expressed by many Iowans. We spoke with Mr. Bob Vanderplatz, who is president and CEO of Family Leader, a pro-family, pro-marriage, pro-life organization. Their headquarters are in Urbandale. Bob Vanderplatz has run twice for governor of the state and I think once for lieutenant governor. So let's listen to what Mr. Vanderplatz had to say about these issues.
Our overall vision is a revived America that would honor God and that would bless its people. The mission is to strengthen families by inspiring Christ-like leadership in the home, in the church, and in government. The three institutions created by God, the church, the family, and government, those three institutions where they intersect, that's really where our focus is at. And so that's what we try to do on a daily basis.
When you were describing the mission of your organization, you were very clear that God created government and there was a God-given purpose for government. Can you elaborate a little bit on what that really means?
The reason God instituted government, our God's a God of order. And so in civics as well, we need order. And the whole deal was to pursue righteousness, those things that are according to God's heart, His principle, His precepts, that we would extol those, we would promote those, we would value those. But things that are against God's heart, we would extinguish those, we would stop those. And so that's really the purpose of government. When Iowa goes first in the nation, as we do, one of the biggest tasks that we have is to find somebody that we can trust. Because when you're hiring somebody, the first thing you have to cross is, do I trust them? And that goes to a level of integrity. But the other piece of it is what we talked about earlier about the purpose of government, is that there is a higher standard, because human beings, by our very nature, we're very selfish people. I'd like to have the world the way Bob sees the world, and Donna would like to have the world the way Donna sees the world.
What do you mean by God creating government? How did God do that?
You go all the way back to Exodus, Moses, and the institution where Moses was taking on so many things and so many needs of the people that it wasn't good. So there needed to be a division, and division of government meaning basically the three branches of them. So you have a local government, a state government, and, you know, like a national government. And so the scriptures are very clear on the role of government, on the purpose of government, and on people who are running for public office. I'll give you an example, Exodus 18:21. Basically, Moses lays out, you know, who should you choose to represent you? I mean, in a representative form of government, who should you choose? And he says you want to choose people who are capable, who are trustworthy, who fear God, and who hate dishonest gain. And I would think today, even when you take a look at the people running for public office, whether it be president or any other office, what we'd want to do is find people who are capable, those who are trustworthy, those who fear God, and those who hate dishonest gain. As a matter of fact, if we had those kind of office holders today, I think our country would look a lot different than what it does today.
What I'm hearing you say is if you are not instituting God's law, humans will essentially be selfish and will not...
Well, without question. I mean, You see it every day. Take a look at a two-year-old, his first word is mine. But the fact is we're saying, no, we'll go with the founders. There's a higher standard here. The law of nature, nature's God. If it's God's law, we should align up with it. If we go away from God's law, whether it be with our foreign policy, whether it be with our indebtedness, whether it be with our economic, domestic policy, marriage and family policy, whatever it is, typically that ends up in a train wreck and gets us into the problems that we sometimes see today. But even going back to the founders and the document that predates the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, where it says the laws of nature and of nature's God, meaning they knew, too, there had to be a higher order, there needed to be a higher standard. Otherwise, everybody wants to live under themselves. When they said nature's God, they capitalized the N, and they capitalized the N on purpose, meaning it goes according to the Creator, which goes back to God again. I think what's true is what the founders intended, law of nature and nature's God. They knew there had to be a higher standard. This isn't so far removed. I mean, this is the very nature of who we are as America.
The founding fathers were very clear about separating church and state. How do you reconcile that?
First of all, the founders never mentioned anything about the separation of church and state. Matter of fact, what they talked about was a lot about the Judeo-Christian values, which this country is founded upon. But they did not want to have a state-run religion.
Right.
They wanted to protect the churches from the state. They never wanted to protect the state from the influence of the church.
Both.
And the reason they put in the law of nature and nature's God, because it was simple enough that all three of us on this call, as well as anybody else, could figure it out. Any fifth grader could figure it out. And so they made it very, very simple. But the fundamental question I get back to that I think you're asking, which I think we do need to ask as a country, and that is, does God exist? And if God does exist, then I would suggest that we line up according to his principles and his precepts. And if God doesn't exist, well, let's just be open about that. We say God doesn't exist. Let's let everybody live the way they want to live. And it becomes a survival of the fittest kind of. But to give you an example with the issues we face. Right now in the foreign policy, obviously we're dealing with a deal with ISIS. You're dealing with nuclear Iran. But what sits at the heart of that is the nation of Israel. And again, scripture is very clear. For those who bless Israel, I will bless. For those who curse Israel, I'll curse. That's Genesis 12, verse 3. So again, we can go back to scripture and say, you know, we want to stand with the nation of Israel. Not only are they a good friend of ours in a very hostile region, but we want to align ourselves with the nation of Israel. We don't want a nuclear Iran. We don't want a threat of ISIS. You take a look at marriage and family. But I believe what the Supreme Court did, what they did is they undefined the institution of marriage. What God designed, one man, one woman, is raising and nurturing their children according to Deuteronomy 6. Us aborting and killing up to 60 million babies today, you know, that's a stain on a society. I believe that we should abide by what the founders laid out.
Are you saying that the government should be a Christian government?
I would obviously love to see it be a Christian government. What the founders laid out, though, is that there is a God. We are not it. And so, therefore, we would be best to adhere and apply to his laws and to his precepts.
How do you do outreach throughout Iowa?
We do outreach in a variety of ways. We host several events, web and social media, and letting our voice be heard and asking people to join our cause with us. We're seeing people of faith being more urgent and more sincere about the application of their faith because they're seeing things running away from the heart of God. And they know that when that happens, it's not long to where a culture will pay the price for that. And so what they're trying to do is stand in the gap, and we applaud them, to try to insist upon, or at least to encourage, Christ-like leadership in the home, church, and government. We team with different missions of saying, how can we reach out? Take a look at a guy like Rick Santorum, Ted Cruz, Mike Huckabee. All of them talk about the need to reach out and to help those who want to realize the American dream, meaning those who are caught into a culture of dependency. And those who want to work and find the dignity of work, and those who want to provide for themselves, and that a lot of times our system is tilted to the very, very rich. And they're saying, there's a better way of doing this. So I think if you listen to that message, and I think it's a message that's gonna win this go around, I think you're going to see not only a lot of the base and the people of faith come out this election, I think you're going to see a lot of the Reagan Democrats, the blue-collar Democrats, coming out in this election as well. So I think it should be very exciting.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time.
This is Local Talk on KHOI, and that was Bob Vanderplatz of The Family Leader. We've been exploring a variety of perspectives leading up to the caucuses. Jill King and her husband are the owners of King's Christian Bookstore in Boone, where presidential candidates Ted Cruz and Rick Santorum have each held rallies. We drove out to the bookstore to find out more.
This is King's Christian Bookstore along Highway 30 in Boone, and we have books, Bibles, music, movies, cards, church supplies, and we're sitting in the coffee shop part, so we also do coffees and cappuccinos and milkshakes. We've lived in Boone for 19 years. The store has been here 7.5 years. My husband was a machine mechanic at 3M in Ames for 30-some years, and I was a pharmacy tech for 20 years, and God just started speaking to Randy about opening a Christian bookstore. And we feel like we kind of sat back and just watched God piece it all together, from the building to the inventory to even these tables and chairs and the rest of the fixtures. It was amazing to watch. We've never been paid by the store, and it's just the two of us.
It's a very pleasant space to be in.
We enjoy it. What we didn't know was that it's ministry in disguise. Hmm. We've met so many people through the store, and total strangers will stand up there at the checkout counter and just pour out their hearts and tell us what's going on in their lives. And then other people will just come in and just stop in to pray for us.
Do people discuss politics when they come into the bookstore?
If they come in here and sit in the coffee shop and drink coffee, they might talk about it. Not so much with me. I really don't get into it too much. I'm an observer.
I was curious about one thing. There's this sign on the wall, 3 for $30 or something like that. 3:30, and then there's like a weapon, like a gun.
It's a gun shop.
It's a gun shop. But is that in this store as well?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Can you explain that?
The gun shop is run by a man who's been in law enforcement in this area for 30, 40 years. He based the name 3:30 Tactics is. In the Old Testament, King David had his fighting men, but he had his top 30 men. And from that 30, he had his top 3 that were his closest men and advisors. So he's used that in the name of 3:30.
So this is a Christian gun shop?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a first for me. I have never heard of that before.
In this building, we have a realtor, an insurance office, a chiropractor, and a gun shop and Christian bookstore.
And the Gunshot and Christian Bookstore in the same facility.
He's been a friend of ours for probably 30 years or more. Uh-huh. So we wouldn't just let anybody set up in here, but we know him and trust him, and he does concealed carry classes.
So you're comfortable having Christian books and articles of faith together with a gun shop?
Yeah. Guns aren't anti-Christian.
You had an event here for Ted Cruz and for Rick Santorum?
Yes.
You're Republicans?
We agree with their beliefs and the things that they stand for.
Could you describe those events?
About the last Monday in December, somebody from Senator Cruz's campaign called and asked if we would host a meet and greet. They were doing retail stops, and we were the first stop of his week-long blitz across the state. And we said, sure. And they came in and set it all up, and they estimated there was 200 to 300 people here. Place was packed.
And that's a lot of people in
yeah,
this room.
Yeah, it was full. And the next day we got a call from Rick Santorum's office asking if they could do something similar the next Monday. On a smaller scale, there was maybe 25 to 30 people here. So it was just a good chance to get to know them a little bit and get to meet them personally. And we'll go to the caucus. We plan to do that. We know several people that are Trump supporters.
Do you know yet who you'll support?
We're still leaning toward Cruz because of his beliefs, and partly once you get to meet somebody, you feel like you know more what they believe.
What resonated with people the most?
He started off referencing our Bible verse on the wall up there. Choose you this day whom you will serve. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And there was amens. You don't usually hear that during a political speech. And he wasn't preaching. He went on and talked about the issues, but he started out with what he bases his life on.
Can you describe a little bit how your religious beliefs influence your decision-making or how you evaluate politicians?
We believe in the principles of the Bible, and that's what we base our life on. It's what we believe our country was founded and built on, and we'd like to see that continue. At the same time, we realize we're electing a president, not necessarily hiring a pastor, and there's a difference in that.
You believe in the separation of church and state?
I guess we'd believe in it as far as the state shouldn't control the church.
But do you think that it's necessary to have a Christian president?
We'd like to. I don't know that it's necessary, as long as they have similar goals and morals and beliefs.
What is important for you?
Probably the most important thing for us would be their stand on abortion. We don't believe in abortion in any circumstance. And we also believe that the country needs to be kept safe from terrorism. It's probably impossible to completely do that, but we at least need to focus on that.
What do you think is important in terms of the safety of the country?
Doing what we can to keep criminals and terrorists out rather than bringing them in. I don't know that anybody can make it completely safe. Mm-hmm. You know, you always hear a lot of promises from candidates all the way around, and you know they can't fulfill everything that they're saying they want to do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for taking time to talk
sure.
with us. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa in the lead-up to the caucus. That was Jill King from King's Christian Bookstore in Boone. And that does it for today. Thank you for joining us. I've been one of your hosts, Ursula Rudenberg, together with Kay Patak, and we've been exploring diverse thoughts and hearts of many Iowans during these last days before the Iowa caucuses.
Today we spoke with Mary LaHaye of Iowa Friends of Companion Animals, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, Bob Vanderplatz, President and CEO of the Family Leader, and Dr. Charles Knicker, Coordinator of the Theologian in Residence Program at the United Church of Christ in Ames, and Jill King of King's Christian Bookstore in Boone.
Local Talk is on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m., and you can also listen to the entire show online at khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. And there you'll also find information and links regarding the people you heard today on the show.
Local Talk was engineered today by Rick Morrison. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD in The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was First Amendment by Reverend Billy and the Church of Stop Shopping.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show, which means you can be part of the team of volunteer reporters. We'll train you, and you will love our community as much as we do. Just contact us at 292-2878 or khoifm.org. And remember, tomorrow will be the Thursday concert here at KHOI Live. Doors open at 6:30, and Strong Like Bear will be performing live in a comfortable cafe atmosphere at 410 Douglas at the station. So join us.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.